Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. We will be talking with Columbia University Professor Matthew Connolly about his new book, just released a month ago on Valentine's Day, entitled The Declassification Engine, What History Reveals About America's Top Secrets. Professor Connolly is also the founder and principal investigator of History Lab at Columbia University. They have been using text mining and artificial intelligence tools to analyze the corpus of all the declassified U.S. government documents they can find. I'm Spencer Graves. Here to help me interview Professor Connolly is Doug Samuelson. Samuelson has a doctorate in operations research, numerous publications and professional journals in that field, and decades of experience in classified research for the Department of Defense and other organizations. Professor Connolly, correct any errors or clarify any ambiguities in that brief bio and add anything else you'd like.
No, that sounds about right. And thanks for having me.
So how did you get interested in this area?
Well, you know, I started out as an historian, 30 years ago. And someone like me who wants to study the history of American foreign relations, you quickly realize that a lot of what you might like to know is still classified. But, you know, back when I began in the 90s, these were boon times because after the end of the Cold War, you know, at one point the U.S. was declassifying 200 million pages of documents every year. But what's happened in more recent years, over the last 20 years, is that that whole system where, you know, government officials decide, even if it's decades after the fact, that they can disclose information that was previously classified, that information, that system rather, has been collapsing. And so, you know, only about a fourth as many documents now get released each year compared to 20 years ago. And so I realized, you know, as an historian, that it's not that there are fewer secrets than before. I mean, as near as we can estimate, there's far more information getting classified now and kept from the public than ever before. Instead, it's just that there's so little investment, you know, in public accountability that, again, you know, decades after the fact, we're still not going to get the full story. So that's how I got interested in this. And I wanted to see whether there are ways using data science you could begin to know, you know, what we don't know.
That's very interesting. What's the most important things you'd like to say to our audience about your work?
Well, by the end of this interview, I'm hoping they'll be riled up and they'll want to get on the phone and start calling their congressmen and senators. Because, you know, the most important thing I think anyone would want to know is that if you think, you know, that historians like me, you know, at least historians are one day going to be able to render judgment based on the full weight of the evidence, I'm sorry to tell you, but it's just not true. You know, we're just not getting the information we need, you know, to do our job as scholars. And that's just going to make it even harder for the American public to do their job as citizens.
So I read in your book something about that it's becoming easy. There's the declassification system is collapsing and the volume of information that's classified is increasing, as you just indicated. And so substantial volumes of material are being destroyed because it's easier to destroy them than even consider declassification. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's always been the case, you know, to be fair, that only a small part of the original documentary record gets preserved in archives and eventually produced to the public. You know, so the National Archives, you know, they would give the figure, you know, back when they're mainly dealing with paper documents, they would say that it's something like 1-3%, right? So that's always been true. It's always been the case, you know, that only a little bit of what government officials produce every day, you know, gets preserved because it's historically important. But, you know, nowadays, since the beginning, really, of electronic record keeping, the National Archives can't even estimate, you know, how much information is getting lost or deleted. And when you look at how they've handled the first generation of electronic records, you know, going back to the 1970s, I think you'd be shocked to find out that, you know, for example, hundreds of thousands of diplomatic cables get deleted sight unseen. I mean, huge, you know, troves of information are getting deleted without anyone even looking at it. And that's because, you know, we haven't developed the technology, you know, to begin using data science methods to begin prioritizing, you know, the review of records that really matter. And also, you know, deciding, you know, of all that information, what part of it is actually dangerous? What part of it could really kill people that does need to be preserved and protected?
Yeah. So your book recommends using artificial intelligence to make those decisions. Am I right?
Not necessarily to make the decisions, but to assist the people who have to make the call. You know, so put yourself in the position, let's say like you're a retired, you know, foreign service officer, or maybe you're a retired, you know, CIA operative. These are often the kind of people who get called in, you know, to review records, decide what can be released. The way things currently stand, there's not even a database of declassified documents to allow those people to find out if information might already be out there, might already be public information, right? So it's not just that, you know, they don't have like the most sophisticated technology. They don't even have the most rudimentary, you know, technology, you know, to do their jobs. And so what ends up happening is they end up looking at these records page by page. And there are only 2,000 of these people across the entire federal government whose job it is to decide what the public is allowed to know. Compare that to how many people are producing classified information. So according to the government, 1.3 million people have top secret security clearances, you know, and millions more people have security clearances at lower levels. So you just look at it. There are millions and millions of people producing classified information every day. There are a couple thousand people with basically no technology to try to sift through it all and decide what could be released. But yes, you know, if they did have technology, there's actually quite a lot you could do to help them, you know, be more efficient. And even you know, while waiting for that, I hope it does one day happen. There's a lot that we could do, the American public can begin to do using these same tools, data science tools, to figure out what's missing.
One of the big issues that causes something to be classified is that the content itself is not all that hot.
Mm-hmm.
But what you could learn about sources and methods from seeing it is, mm-hmm. One of the little exercises I remember being given was, they give you this report, but I'm on al-Zawahiri and three of his associates met at 10 o'clock on Friday at al-Zawahiri's flat, and they talked about a plot. You go through a few paragraphs of what kind of bomb they were going to use on the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. What's the most sensitive piece of information in this document? And the answer turns out to be the time and place of the meeting. Because if they knew that we knew exactly the time and place of the meeting, they might start wondering how we knew.
Right, right. Now, you know, that's what they call the mosaic theory.
Yes, exactly.
And it's not a new idea, right? You can go back. George Washington had this idea, right? I mean, this is just one of the things, you know, like when you want to collect intelligence, like, you know, individual facts may not tell you very much, but when you can fit them together into a mosaic, it can reveal a larger pattern. One of the things I think is going to be very interesting to see in the near future is, you know, when people begin using large language models, things like ChatGPT type systems, to aggregate information in order to reveal things that maybe you wouldn't know otherwise, right? Because these kinds of systems are quite efficient, right? In aggregating huge amounts of information and generating text, you know, that would respond to like plain questions that you and I might ask. The thing you need though, to make that system complete is that you would have to have it produce the data upon which the answer is based, right? So that's not what you're seeing now. When you go to ChatGPT and you formulate a question about this or that, when the answer is erroneous, you're never going to find out why it got it, right? So that's the kind of thing that we're going to be seeing, I think, in the very near future. And it's going to be a whole new ballgame.
Right. So we are talking with Columbia University Professor Matthew Connelly about his new book, just released a month ago on Valentine's Day, entitled The Declassification Engine, What History Reveals About America's Top Secrets.
The first generation of electronic records, State Department cables from the 1970s. There are millions and millions of them. And year by year, when they go through them and decide what can be released to the public, fewer and fewer of them are getting out. Now, one interesting fact is that that's increasingly the case, even with the cables that were never classified to begin with. And yes. One reason for that is that a lot of those cables have what they call personally identifiable information. It has information about people's social security numbers, phone numbers, bank account numbers. And so, you know, we're talking until this point, you know, about national security information, but a lot of what's getting withheld is PII, right? Personally identifiable information.
Yeah. And that leads to a question I think you might want to look at, because you've said in your book, and you sort of said earlier a little bit in this interview, it's very hard to say what's being lost because it's classified and never revealed. We have another area in which the consequences of improper revelation are easier to find, and they're more numerous and they're easier to track, and that's health information. When we got HIPAA 20 years ago, the privacy advocates won a battle they shouldn't have been allowed to win. Everything is PII. Everything is kind of confidential and private. There are epidemiology studies you can't do anymore because nobody can have access to the data because they, you know. Yeah. Okay, well, here's an area where we know what the consequences of disclosure would be. Can we measure whether there was over-restriction? Can we measure whether there was harm to going too far?
Every president since Truman, with the exception of Donald Trump, has issued an executive order that was meant to, you know, regulate and control, you know, the production of and protection of national security information, right? Because this is one part of our government where the president is almost completely sovereign, right? There's really no effective check on the power that presidents have and deciding what the rest of us are allowed to know. And so the way this works, or the way it doesn't work too, is that they issue these executive orders and the rest of the executive branch is supposed to follow the rules. And most of these executive orders, if you read them, will say that, you know, we should try to classify as little as possible, and even less should be classified at the highest level. We want to reduce the numbers of people who are creating secrets. We want to automatically declassify information that's more than 25 years old. It sounds great. But, you know, first of all, when you read between the lines, what you begin to realize is that all these efforts are about consolidating that power over secrecy within the White House, right? So whether it's about, you know, limited number of people who are allowed to create original secrets, or, you know, it's about only classifying, you know, the most sensitive information at the highest level, or whether it's about like automatically so-called declassifying information of previous administrations, all those things would have the effect, if they actually work, of consolidating control over what's still secret within the White House, right? So that's what it's really about. But the problem is, you know, once you conjure this power of secrecy, it can run out of control. And so even though presidents over and over again have tried to, you know, bring this system under control, they fail because, you know, once you allow people, you know, across the federal government to begin creating secrets, they'll keep doing it and they're going to do it for their reasons, their own reasons.
Exactly right.
You mentioned that in your book, and this is, I think, again, a piece of folklore many of us already know, that classification often happens not because it's sensitive, but because it could be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you look at the first draft executive order, you go back to Truman's, the original language was that they were going to classify information that they thought would be harmful, you know, to the like reputation, the prestige. I think they used the word prestige, the prestige of the United States. And so,
that's,
you know,
everything.
Journalists got a hold of that and they mocked it, right? Made fun of the idea that, you know, government officials are going to protect American prestige. So they eventually dropped that. But that idea has been there all along. I mean, anybody would tell you that over and over again, you know, officials will classify information just to try to protect reputations and cover up incompetence.
Israel is fighting that battle right now. They had a new piece of legislation proposed that it would be illegal to publish in news media anything that was derogatory to the state of Israel, which of course means any criticism of the current government would be illegal. Obviously there's been some pushback, but this impetus is always there from people in power.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and it's just one example among many about why it is we can't just let them do as they wish. Right. There has to be some external check. And that's why I think it's time, high time, you know, for Congress and the courts to step up, because this is the one part of our government that's almost completely sovereign, right, and unaccountable. And the only way, you know, that we're going to see real change is if Congress and the courts start using their powers to bring them in check.
Good luck with this, Congress. But yeah.
Well, you know, actually, I've been very encouraged in the last few weeks. I've been talking with people on different Senate committees, and it seems like there's real interest. I'm not saying anything's going to come of it necessarily, but, you know, what I'm finding is that several different Senate committees now are actively considering, you know, the possibility of new legislation.
Talk about the 1953 Supreme Court decision in U.S. versus Reynolds.
Oh, so this is a precedent that's been cited over 800 times now in federal court. And typically they cite this precedent, U.S. versus Reynolds, in order to deny people their appeals for the Freedom of Information Act. You know, so when you say, you know, I'd like to find out whether it's about the Kennedy assassination or UFOs or whatever, you know, most of these requests are denied, at least in part, if not in full. And so even if you get to hire a lawyer and you go to a court, you know, typically judges won't even look at the records you've requested. And they'll say that, you know, based on that precedent, they're not allowed, you know, and they basically take it on faith when government lawyers tell them that it's national security information. And so what's interesting about that case is it involved a airplane crash where a bomber that had been fitted out with electronics from RCA and had RCA technicians on board crashed, you know, during one of these experiments. And widows of those RCA technicians, they sued. And during the discovery phase, they tried to get hold of the accident report, you know, to find out why it crashed and why their husbands had died. And, you know, they were told by the Secretary of the Air Force that that was national security information that would jeopardize the security of the United States if it was disclosed. And eventually, you know, the you know, judges agreed. And that was the basis for this decision. You know, again, that's been cited hundreds of times ever since. When that report eventually was released, there was no national security information. There was nothing in there, you know, that would have endangered any American lives. What they found, in fact, was that the Air Force had covered up the incompetence, you know, that had led to this accident. You know, the fact that these men had never been trained in safety procedures, the plane was not airworthy, like it had a known defect that had not been corrected. So this is what they were covering up. And it was based on that case, you know, again, that over and over again, American citizens have been denied all kinds of information about our government. Unfortunately, the way things are now, a lot of stories about national security are stories that are based on leaked documents. And where do those leaks come from? It's not typically like the Edward Snowdens of the world. Usually leaks come from senior officials, right? These are more like plants than leaks. I have a colleague, David Posey, he calls them pleaks. Yep. So basically, you know, they'll release documents or at least they'll share information that allows them to get their story across. And they're in that way, they try to manage the news and manage what people are allowed to know. So nobody more than journalists, I think, should be motivated to try to make sure the rest of us are allowed to have the full story.
Indeed. So give me some examples of the serious negative consequences of excessive secrecy. You quoted Leo Szilard, one of the leading scientists in the development of the nuclear bomb, as saying the rules for secrecy added 18 months to the development of the atomic bomb, which means it might have been shortened the Second World War, might have been over before D-Day. Your comment?
Yeah, another great book that came out not long ago called Restricted Data, which is all about the Manhattan Project, right? And one of the really startling things Alex Wellerstein was able to show is that this was, you know, supposedly like the best kept secret, right? Where, you know, and it's true, like even Harry Truman didn't know about the Manhattan Project as long as Roosevelt was still president. So it was kept, you know, not just, you know, from the American public, but it's also kept from Congress, even like very senior officials in the executive branch, even the Navy was not allowed to know about the Manhattan Project. But on the other hand, you know, what eventually was revealed was how a lot of other countries knew about it. I mean, clearly the Soviet Union knew about it. They thoroughly infiltrated the Manhattan Project. But so did Germany. I mean, it's not that they didn't know that the United States had a program to try to build atomic bombs. So they didn't actually succeed in keeping this information from our enemies. And so, yeah, you have to ask yourself, like, let's say they didn't take these extraordinary measures where they put, you know, research projects out in the desert, you know, and did all these other things. It actually made it extremely difficult and extremely, you know, challenging, you know, to build these weapons. And yeah, as Szilard said, that if they hadn't done that, it would have been much faster. You know, they could have been deploying atomic bombs a lot sooner, maybe even as early as 1944. And so you have to be a little bit of a counterfactual historian just trying to play that out. But yeah, I think that if they had atomic bombs in the middle of 1944, then I could imagine that they wouldn't necessarily have had to mount the kind of invasions and amphibious operations that they did. They wouldn't have had to slog their way all across Western Europe. I mean, we can't know for sure, but I mean, it's the kind of thing that makes very tangible the fact that, you know, this information, when they keep it from us, it doesn't necessarily save lives. It doesn't actually necessarily make us safe.
On the other hand, we know that the leak from the Rosenbergs to the Soviets speeded up their development by quite a bit.
So, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
There was a rationale for secrecy if we had managed to maintain it.
That's right. And you know what? There's always going to be a trade-off, right? I mean, one thing I would say is that it's never absolute, right? You can't, and we've seen this for decades now, many, many senior officials have said that, you know, usually you can't keep secrets for more than a year or two. Right. So you have to ask yourself, like, yep, what is to be gained and what might be lost, right, from the different levels of classification, the kind of secrecy you shroud yourself. So for sure, like, you have to look at these trade-offs. But, you know, when people will tell you, like a president or a CIA director would say, like, well, yeah, we of course, you know, we try to balance like national security on the one hand with like transparency and accountability on the other. Don't believe them. It's nonsense, because it's like what Joe Biden said. You want to know what somebody values? Look at their budget.
Yeah.
What do they spend their money on? Right. Okay. So if you're really trying to balance these things and you're spending $18.4 billion on secrecy, and you're spending less than or barely half of 1%, $100 million on declassification, obviously you don't give a crap about transparency and accountability. If you did, then you put some resources behind it.
Yes.
Right. So we're essentially out of time. If we have time for one more question, Professor Connolly, why don't I give Doug the last question?
Well, I already asked the one about how well can you train an AI in an area where you can't really give the AI some of the information it needs to have. And then the answer that an AI could help with something like inter-rater reliability is good, but what limits do you see on what we could do with AI beyond what humans can do that would help here? Don't AIs have some of the same tunnel vision problems that we do,
yeah,
with information that they simply can't see?
Yeah, the old saying, you know, garbage in, garbage out, it absolutely applies. When we're talking about training data, if all the training data we're talking about is, you know, officials who might be overclassifying information, right, and maybe overzealous, then of course, you know, the system is not going to do better than that. That said, you know, what a system like that could do is it could at least begin identifying outliers, right? I mean, the things that don't look right, like officials who are releasing altogether too little and overclassifying way too much, right? So, and you could also begin trying to correct for these kinds of things, right? You could identify the things that, you know, the algorithm predicts, you know, should be released, and if people are still withholding it, then you begin at least, you know, to provide a little bit better training, right? So these are the kinds of things like we can begin to nudge people in the right direction. It's not going to be a silver bullet, but it has to be part of any solution.
And as soon as somebody figures out that there's an AI that could identify an agency or maybe an individual who seems to be overclassifying consistently and suggests that this might be to cover up incompetence, that program is going to get shut down at the speed of light. What do you do about that?
Yeah. Well, there's what's going to happen in the government, or maybe what won't happen, and then there's what the rest of us could do to do our job as citizens. And there's a lot we can do right now, like even using declassified documents, millions and millions of them. There's a lot we can discover already that we might not know otherwise. And that's why I wrote the book, because I wanted to show, you know, what's possible. But one of the points I make is that's it's the floor. It's not the ceiling, right? Some of the things that we're doing, they weren't even invented 20 years ago. And we're just seeing like incredible, you know, progress, you know, to use that old fashioned term, in the field of computer science. And why wouldn't we? I mean, we're throwing billions of dollars at this and incredibly talented people to develop, you know, more generic kinds of solutions that work for the private sector. So at least some of the crumbs from that table, I think, are going to be pretty delicious when we start using them to understand what the government's been up to.
What would you suggest that your colleagues in the journalism school at Columbia start teaching their students to make them more intelligent reporters?
Well, you know, I took classes at the journalism school, and it's because I wanted to learn how to code. It's in fact, much sooner than historians, journalists have understood that we need to begin figuring out ways that we can analyze text as data, right? And they call it like data-driven journalism. So yes. I have to take my hat off because, you know, the journalists have been dealing with these kinds of problems longer than we have, and they've been working on them. And one reason is that they're under such pressure, right? I mean, it's really tough now to make a career in journalism. So they're actually being quite inventive. Humanists, we've got our problems too. So I think we're going to see more like historians and others, you know, begin realizing that it's at least possible and maybe ultimately necessary to reinvent our discipline as a kind of data science, right? And so that's the sort of thing I think we could do collaboratively. And I've had, you know, good luck over the years having partnerships with journalists, with data scientists, because to be honest, like when we're dealing with things like unaccountable government, we're all in this together. Even you, Doug, even you, Spencer.
No fooling.
I may actually have had a dog in this fight a little bit in my career already.
Ditto. We have been talking. I think our time has expired. Professor Conley is probably going to want to dash out the door for another appointment. We have been talking with Columbia University Professor Matthew Conley about his new book, just released a month ago on Valentine's Day, entitled The Declassification Engine, What History Reveals About America's Top Secrets. Links to the Wikipedia article on Conley and a summary of this book are available in the description of this episode of Radioactive Magazine at kkfi.org. Click News and Public Affairs, then Radioactive Magazine. I'm Spencer Gray.
One summary. You mentioned a few times now how it came out on Valentine's Day. And, you know, originally I thought that was really unfortunate, right? Who's going to give their partner, their wife or husband or girlfriend or boyfriend or whoever a copy of the Declassification Engine? But then I did this interview with John Stewart, and I'll give you his summary. He said, this is a book about America's love of secrecy. what I would add to that is, unfortunately, secrecy does not love us back.
That's right. No fooling. I'm Spencer Graves. Doug Samuelson has been my co-interviewer. Thank you for listening.